oven. The crust on them was an inch thick, and so short and flaky it looked like scorched tissue paper. "Well, kitten," he said contentedly to his stomach as he took his seat, humbly in the kitchen where the grooms and such were fed, while their betters ate in the dining rooms. "You were going to have more than a saucer of milk today. How'd you like, say, 5 of those little squabs?" But when he began to give his order to the serving maid, she giggled and ran off for the landlady. "Now, boy," this lady said to him firmly, "you just show me the color of your money." Satisfied, she grunted and told the maid to serve the little master. This young girl was hardly older than Scylla. She could not help laughing at the things he ordered. The 5 little squabs, 3 of each kind of pastry, a wreath of jellied eels, because she said it was a specialty of the house, a tipsy parson, white bread tied into little knots, buttered and baked, and a pot of coffee and another of chocolate. When Johnny saw a dish being prepared in the kitchen for some diner in the other room, he would call for some of that, and she giggled again and fetched it for him. There was only one disappointment. The smell of coffee had always attracted him. He was disappointed at the bitter taste. The chocolate, however, was even better than he had dared to hope. But when he came to pay, he was chagrined to find so much of his money had gone to fill and overfill his stomach. The kitten was no longer gnawing inside him, trying to get out. In fact, it was no longer a kitten. "I feel as if I had swallowed a Newfoundland dog and it had died on me." What a fool he had been! He thought suddenly of Rab, that Rab wouldn't have let himself go so. And for the first time, standing in the cobbled stable yard behind the inn, he realized that the back of the little building he saw beyond the Afric Queen stables was the printing shop of the Boston Observer on Salt Lane. He wanted to cross through the backyards, go to see that Rab, but thought better of it. Not until he came as a friend and equal, not as a beggar. No. He decided he would buy himself some shoes. His own flapped as he walked. His toes showed, but he hadn't liked it when Jehu had referred to him as a boy with broken shoes. As he left the cobbler's, his new shoes squeaking on his feet, he saw a peddler pushing a barrow of limes up Cornhill. "Fine lemons and limes, lemons and limes." There was nothing in the world Izana so craved as limes, and Mrs. Lapham could not buy them for her. They were too dear. But sometimes sailors from the Indies or storekeepers would give her one, because she was so beautiful and would hug and kiss anyone who gave her a lime. Johnny filled the pockets of his jacket and breeches with limes. Now, for Scylla. He could not buy her a gray pony, a gold necklace, nor a little sailboat. He went to a stationer's. There he found a book with the most wonderful pictures of Calvinistic martyrs, dying horrible but prayerful deaths. He glanced at the text. With his help, she would soon be able to read it. Next he bought pastel crayons, but he passionately regretted all those squabs. He had no money left to get her drawing paper. His new shoes fitted to a nicety. If the Newfoundland dog was a heavier tenant in his stomach than the kitten, it was more restful. His pockets were full of fine gifts. He whistled as he walked and entered the Lapham kitchen ready to tell of his adventure with Mr. Hancock. The women folk had spent all day paring apples, threading them on strings, preparing to dry them for the winter. Even Mrs. Lapham looked tired. The lazy apprentice bursting in, happy for the first time in 2 months, irritated her. Then she saw his new shoes. "Johnny Tremaine," she cried, "what have you been up to?" "What?" "You wicked, wicked boy! Oh, I declare you are going to bring disgrace on us all." He did not understand. "Them shoes," she roared. "You never got them honestly. You've taken to thieving. I'm going to tell your master. He'll call a constable and then see if you dares not tell where you stole them. You've just gone from worse to worse. You're going to get whipped for this, set in the stocks. You're going to jail. You'll end up on the gallows." He let her scold, shake her wattles at him. As she flounced out of the room, Madge and Dorcas saw their chance to escape for a moment. All afternoon, Frizzell, Junior, the leather dresser, had been standing outside on the street waiting for one or the other to come out. Frizzell Jr. was an accepted suitor, but no one knew whether it was Madge or Dorcas he was after. Mrs. Lapham didn't know. The girls didn't know. Frizzell Jr. himself did not seem to know. Both Madge and Dorcas were now wild to get out and after him. It looked as though whichever one was not Mrs. Frizzell would end up Mrs. Tweedy. Johnny stood before Scylla and Izana, who had huddled together in a corner of the settle like frightened little animals as their mother accused Johnny of theft. He smiled and they smiled. He was so happy about his gifts that he forgot his misfortunes. Scylla said happily, "I know you didn't steal." "Of course not. Look, girl, I've got crayons for you." He put them on the table. "For me?" "And a book with pictures. Now, Syl, the printing is so easy, I think you can almost teach yourself to read."
"Oh, Johnny, look, look at that funny little man. See, he's got tiny little buttons on his coat. Oh, I never thought to own a book with pictures."
He began fishing limes out of his frayed pockets. Izana jumped about him like a puppy. "Limes, limes," she cried. They began to fall on the floor, rolling in all directions. All three children went down after them. Scylla was almost happier over Izana's pleasure than her own. Johnny was happiest of all. For the first time, he completely forgot his crippled hand. It was all as if nothing had happened, and he and Scylla and Izana were all one again. He was pretending not to give the limes to the little girl. He was going to put them back in his pockets, but she knew they were for her. She wrapped herself about him, hugging him, kissing the front of his shirt. This was as far as she could reach. He started to pick her up in his arms, hold her over his head until she said, "Please, pretty!" Suddenly, Izana's delighted cries changed to hysterical screams. "Don't touch me! Don't touch me with that dreadful hand!" Johnny stopped. It was the worst thing anyone had said to him. He stood like stone, his hand thrust back into his pocket. Scylla froze, too, half under the kitchen table, a lime in her hand.
"Oh, Izana, how could you?"
The nervous child went on screaming,
"Go away, Johnny, go away, I hate your hand!"
Scylla slapped her, and she burst into tears. So he went away. 5. Now he was sure that what they all felt Izana had been young enough to say. He felt his heart was broken. Once again he started to walk until he was so tired he could not think. The long, late September night had already begun before he reached the town gates on the neck. Beyond him, in the semi-darkness, running across mud flats, was the one road which connected Boston with the mainland. And here the gallows, on which Mrs. Lapham promised him to end. He turned back from the lonely place. The gallows and the graves of suicides frightened him a little. He wandered about through the salt marshes at the foot of the common, circling until he came out on Beacon Hill. There he sat in an orchard for quite a while. It was either Mr. Light's or Mr. Hancock's, for the houses stood side by side. He saw the glitter of candles throughout the great mansions, guests coming and going, heard the music of a spinet. Izana's words rang in his ears. He, who had struggled hard never to cry, now wished that he could. Then he walked off into sparsely settled West Boston. Behind the pest house by lantern light, men were digging a hurried grave. He left West Boston and, skirting dirty Mill Cove, came at last into his own North Boston. On Hull Street he heard the staves of the town watch and the feet of the watchmen clumping on cobbles. By law, no apprentice was allowed out so late. He slipped into Copse Hill graveyard to hide until they were gone.
1 o'clock and a warm, fair night," called the watch.
It was indeed warm and fair, and no hardship to spend such a night out under the moon and stars. Around about him everywhere lay the dead worthies of Boston. Their slate stones stood shoulder to shoulder. This was the highest land in Boston, next only to Beacon Hill. Here, close to Hull Street, his mother was buried in an unmarked grave. He had not forgotten where, and flung himself down beside the spot. Then he began to cry. He had not been able to cry before. It was as if Izana's words had broken down the last strength in him. He cried half for himself, and half because he knew how sorry his mother would be for him if she knew. "I can't do decent work. I can't ever be a silversmith, not even a watchmaker. My friends don't want me to touch them with my dreadful hand." Seemingly neither the moon nor the stars above him nor the dead about him cared. Then he lay his face down, sobbing and saying over and over that God had turned away from him. But his frenzied weeping had given him some release. He must have slept. He sat up suddenly, wide awake. The moon had seemingly come closer and closer to him. He could see the coats of arms, the winged death's heads, on the slate stones about him. He was so wide awake he felt someone must have called his name. His ears were straining to hear the next words. What was it his mother had said long ago? If there was nothing left and God himself had turned away his face, then, and only then, Johnny was to go to Mr. Light. In his ears rang his mother's sweet remembered accents. Surely for one second, between sleeping and waking, he had seen her dear face, loving, gentle, intelligent, floating toward him through the moonlight on Copp's Hill. He sat a long time with his arms hugging his knees. Now he knew what to do. This very day he would go to Merchant Light. When at last he lay down, he slept heavily, without a dream, and without a worry. Chapter 4 The Rising Eye. It was past dawn when he woke, his feeling of contentment still in him. He was no longer his own problem, but Merchant Light's. Tomorrow at this time, what would he be calling him? Uncle Jonathan? Cousin Light? Or perhaps Grandpa? And he laughed out loud. Only imagine how Mrs. Lapham would come running, dropping nervous curtsies, when he drove up in that ruby coach. How Madge and Dorcas would stare. First thing he did would be to take Cilla for a drive. He'd not even invite Izana. But how she would bawl when left behind, and then his imagination jumped ahead. At the Charlestown ferry slip he washed in the cold seawater, and because the sun was warm, sunned himself as he did what he could do to make his shabby clothes presentable. He combed his lank, fair hair with his fingers, cleaned his nails with his teeth. Of course, now he could buy Cilla that pony and cart. And Grandpa Lapham? Ah, he'd buy him a Bible with print an inch high in it. Mrs. Lapham? Not a thing, madam. Not one thing. Christ's Church said 10 o'clock. He'd got up and started for Long Wharf, where his great relative had his counting house. On his way down, he passed Salt Lane. There was the comical little painted man observing Boston through his tiny spyglass. Johnny wanted to stop, tell that fellow, that Rab, of his great connections, but decided to wait until he was sure of his welcome into the Light family. Although half of him was leaping ahead, imagining great things for himself, the other half was wary. It was quite possible he would get no welcome at all, and he knew it. He walked half the length of Long Wharf until he saw carved over a door the familiar rising eye. The door was open, but he knocked. None of the three clerks sitting on their high stools with their backs to him, scratching in ledgers, looked up, so he stepped inside. Now that he had to speak, he found there was a barrier across his throat, something that he would have to struggle to get his voice over. He was more excited than he had realized, but he was scornful, too. These three clerks would not even look up when he came in today, but tomorrow, what would it be? "Good morning, little master. I'll tell your uncle, cousin, grandfather that you are here, sir." Finally, a well-fed, rosy youth, keeping one finger in his ledger, swung around and asked him what he wanted. "It is a personal matter between myself and Mr. Light." "Well," said the young man pleasantly, "even if it is personal, you'd better tell me what it is." "It is a family matter.
I cannot, in honor, tell anyone except Mr. Light.
Hmm.
One of the elderly clerks laughed in a mean way. Just another poor suitor for the hand of Miss Lavinia. The young clerk flushed. Johnny had seen enough of Madge and Dorcas and their suitors to know that the jibe about poor boys aspiring to Miss Lavinia had gone home. "Tell him," snickered the other ancient spider of a clerk, "that Mr. Light is,
sensible of the great honor, and regrets to say that he has formed other plans for his daughter's future. Ah."
Evidently, he mimicked Mr. Light. The young clerk was scarlet. He flung down his pen.
"Can't you ever forget that?" he protested.
"Here, kid," and turned to Johnny. "Mr. Light's closeted behind that door with two of his sea captains. When they leave, you just walk in." Johnny sat modestly on a stool, his arrogant shabby hat in his good hand, and looked about him. Three backs were bent once more over the ledgers. The quill pens scratched. He heard the gritting of sand as they blotted their pages. There was a handsome half-model of a ship on the wall. Sea chests, doubtless full of charts, maps, invoices, were under the desks. The door opened. Two ruddy men with swaying walks stepped out, and Mr. Light himself was shaking hands, bidding them success on their voyaging and God's mercy. As he turned to go back to his sanctuary, Johnny followed him. Mr. Light sat himself in a red leather armchair beside an open window. Through that window he could watch his western star graving in the graving dock. He would have been a handsome man, with his fine dark eyes, bushy black brows, contrasting smartly with the white tie wig he wore, except for the color and quality of his flesh. It was as yellow as tallow. Seemingly it had melted and run down. The lids were heavy over the remarkable eyes. The melted flesh made pouches beneath them. It hung down along his jawbone, under his jutting chin.
"What is it?" he demanded. "Who let you in? What do you want, and who, for heaven's sake, are you?"
"Sir," said Johnny, "I'm Jonathan Light Tremaine." There was a long pause. The merchant's glittering black eyes did not waver, nor the tallow cheeks redden. If the name meant anything to him, he did not show it.
"Well?"
"My mother, sir." The boy's voice shook slightly. "She told me she always said..." Mr. Light opened his jeweled snuff box, took snuff, sneezed, and blew his nose.
"I can go on from there, boy. Your mother on her deathbed told you you were related to the rich Boston merchant?"
Johnny was sure now Mr. Light knew of the relationship. "Yes, sir, she did. But I didn't know you'd know."
"No? I didn't need to know. It's a very old story, a very old trick, and will you be gone, or shall I have you flung out?"
"I'll stay," Johnny said stubbornly. "Sewell?" The merchant did not raise his voice, but instantly the young clerk was on his threshold.
"Show him out, Sewell, and happens he lands in the water, you, can baptize him with my name,
Mr. Light took up a handful of papers. The incident was over. Sewell looked at Johnny and Johnny at Sewell. The young man was as kind as his cherubic face suggested.
"I can prove to you one thing, Mr. Light. My name is Jonathan Light Tremaine." "What of it? Any back-alley drab-tail can name a child for the greatest men in the colony. There should be a law against it, but there is none."
Johnny's temper began to go.
"You flatter yourself. What have you ever done except be rich? Why, I doubt even a monkey mother would name a monkey child after you."
Mr. Light gave a long whistle.
"Well, that was quite a mouthful. Sewell?"
"Yes, sir."
"You just take this monkey child of a monkey mother out and drown it."
"Yes, sir." Sewell put a soft hand on the boy's shoulder, but Johnny fiercely shook himself free.
"I don't want your money,"
he said, more proudly than accurately. Now that I've met you face to face, I don't much fancy you as kin.
Your manners, my boy, are a credit to your mother.
But facts are facts, and I've a cup with your arms on it to prove what I say is true. The merchant's unhealthy, brilliant eyes quivered and glittered.
You've got a cup of mine?
No, of mine.
So you've got a cup. Will you describe it?
Johnny described it as only a silversmith could.
Why, Mr. Light, that must be...
Sewell began, but Mr. Light hushed him. Evidently, not only Mr. Light, but his clerks had heard of this cup. Johnny was elated.
My boy, said the merchant, you have, brought me great news. I must see your cup.
Anytime you say, sir.
My long-lost cup returned to me by my long-lost little... Whatever you are.
Ka-choo!
He had taken more snuff.
Bring your cup to me tonight. You know my Beacon Hill house?
Yes, sir.
And we'll kill the fatted calf, you long-lost whatever you are. Come an hour after candles are lit. Prodigal son, what? Got a cup, has he?
2. Although Johnny might have been more cordially received by Merchant Light, he was satisfied enough with his welcome to build up air castles. He really knew they were air castles, for at bottom he was hard-headed, not easily taken in even by his own exuberant imagination. Still, as he trudged up Fish Street, turned in at the Lapham's door, in his mind he was in that ruby coach, money and a watch in his pocket. He had hoped to slip up to the attic and fetch away his cup without being noticed, but Mrs. Lapham saw him enter and called him into the kitchen. She said nothing about his shoes. Evidently the girls had told her his story and she had believed it.
"Johnny, you come set a moment. No, girls, you needn't leave. I want you to hear what I'm going to say."
Johnny looked a little smug. Had he not almost arrived in the light coach?
"Grandpa says as long as he live, you are to have a place to sleep. But you've got to go back to the attic. Mr. Tweedy's to have the birth and death room, and you can have a little somewhat to eat. I've agreed that's all right. I'll manage somehow.
Don't fret. I'm going for good."
"I'll believe that when I see it. Now, mind, I've two things to say to you."
The four girls were all sitting about, hands folded as though they were at a meeting.
"First, you shan't insult Mr. Tweedy, least not until he has signed the contract. No more talk of his being a spinster aunt dressed up in men's clothes. And no more squeak pigs. He's sensitive. You hurt his feelings horribly. He almost took ship then and there back to Baltimore."
"I'm sorry."
"Secondly, there's to be no more talk of you and Scylla. Don't you ever dare to lift your eyes to one of my girls again."
"Lift my eyes? I can't see that far down into dirt even to know they are there."
"Now, you saucebox, you hold that tongue of yours. You're not going to go hanging around Scylla, giving her presents, and dear knows how you got the money. I've told her to keep shy of you. Now I'm telling you, you mark my words. Ma'am, I wouldn't marry that sniveling, goggle-eyed frog of a girl, even though you gave her to me on a golden platter. Fact is, I don't like girls, nor, with a black look at his mistress, women either, and that goes for Mr. Tweedy, too."
He left to go upstairs for his cup. When he came down, the more capable women of the household were out in the yard hanging up the wash. Scylla was paring apples in that deft, absent-minded way she did such things. Izana was eating the parings. She'd be sick before nightfall. Scylla lifted her pointed, translucent little face. Her hazel eyes, under their veil of long lashes, had a greenish flash to them. There never was a less goggle-eyed girl.
"Johnny's mad," she said sweetly. "His ears are red. He's mad," Izana chanted.
These words sounded wonderful to him. He was happy because once more they were insulting him,
They were not pitying him or being afraid of him because he had had an accident. Goggle-eyed, sniveling frogs. With his silver cup in his flannel bag, he set off to kill time until he might take it to Mr. Light. He spent a couple of hours dreaming of his rosy future, and the tears in Merchant Light's unhealthy, brilliant black eyes, the tremor in his pompous, manner of speech as he clutched his long-lost whatever-you-are to his costly waistcoat. Even if he did not like women, Miss Lavinia, he decided, was to kiss him on the brow. Through this dreaming, he felt enough confidence in his good fortune at last to stop in and see that Rab. There had not been a day since the first meeting that he had not wanted to. Rab showed no surprise either over his return or the strange story that he proceeded to pour out. It was nightfall and, as Johnny hoped, Uncle Lorne and the little Webbs were gone. Rab was waiting for the ink to dry on the observer so he could fold it. He sat with his long legs stretched before him, his hands clasped behind his neck. "Light's crooked, you know," he said at last. "I've heard that before." "He's sly. When the merchants agreed not to import any English goods until the Stamp Act was repealed, he was one of the first to sign, then imported secretly. Sold through another name. Made more money. Sam Adams spoke to him privately. Scared him. He says he won't do that again. He's trying to ride two horses, Whig and Tory." Johnny's life with the Laphams had been so limited he knew little of the political strife which was turning Boston into two armed camps. The Whigs declaring that taxation without representation is tyranny, the Tories believing all differences could be settled with time, patience, and respect for government. Rab obviously was a Whig. "I can stomach some of the Tories," he went on. "Men like Governor Hutchinson. They honestly think that we're better off to take anything from the British Parliament, let them break us down, stamp in our faces, take all we've got by taxes, and never protest. They say we American colonies are too weak to get on without England's help and guidance. But Governor Hutchinson's a good man. Of course, we'll destroy him. We've marked him down. Sam Adams is already greasing the ways under him. But I can't stand men like Light, who care nothing for anything except themselves and their own fortune, playing both ends against the middle." "I'd never have picked him for a relative, but beggars can't be choosers. And it happens I'm a beggar. It's on time to get ready to go to him." Understanding Johnny's unspoken desire not to appear too meanly before the great gentleman, Rab went to the attic above the shop where he slept and came down with a clean shirt of the finest white linen and a fawn-colored corduroy jacket with silver buttons. "It's too small for me. Ought to about fit you." It did. Almost miraculously, for Johnny had not seen where it came from, bread and cheese were on the counter. It was his first food since yesterday's gorging. With the straight, fair hair well brushed and tied behind with taffeta, the handsome jacket, the frilled, immaculate shirt, Johnny did cut a very presentable figure. By the printing shop clock, the sun had been set for almost an hour. Rab was folding newspapers. "You can sleep here," he said, "if they don't offer you anything. But good luck, bold fellow." 3. Standing on Beacon Hill, so far removed from the hurly-burly of the wharves, shops, markets of town, Johnny hesitated. Should he, as a poor, out-of-work apprentice, go round back, or should he, as a long-lost something or other, raise that gleaming brass knocker on the paneled front door? The silver buttons and Rab's bold fellow heartened him. The knocker fell, and instantly a maid was bidding him enter, curtsying, asking his name. "I'm Jonathan Light Tremaine." The front hall was very large. From it rose a flight of stairs, taking their time in their rising, taking all the space they needed. Along the walls were portraits, Merchant Light in his handsome, healthy youth, Lavinia, painted long before in London, as regal a child as now she was a young woman. Time blackened old things, already 100 years old. Was it their long, dried blood which now ran red and living in Johnny's veins? To the left was the drawing room. The tinkle of a spinet, Low voices. Laughter. Could it be they were laughing because the maid was announcing him? He wished he had called himself merely Johnny Tremaine. That was Merchant Light.
Fetch him in, Jenny. Just a little family party. All want to see him, eh?
Johnny's first impression was of dozens of wax candles lighting the long, dove-colored and lavender and yellow room. They were reflected in mirrors, silver, gleaming floors, and mahogany. A dozen people were gathered together in the far end of the room. Johnny stood a moment, anxious to do nothing wrong, conscious that the new shoes he had been so proud of did not much resemble the little black-buckled pumps on the gentleman.
"Well," said Mr. Light, rising but not approaching him. "So, here we are."
"Yes, sir."
"Lavinia, Cousin Talbot, Aunt Best. How do you like his looks?"
Aunt Best, a horrifyingly ugly, cross old woman with two gold-headed canes, vowed through her whiskers and toothless gums that he looked just as bad as she had expected. Lavinia turned from the spinet. She had on a stiff turquoise blue dress that suited her marvelously. She looked at the boy with her head tipped sideways as Johnny had seen other ladies look at silver teapots before they bought.
"At least, Papa, he's a deal handsomer than most of my relatives. Isn't he, Cousin Sewell?"
It was the rosy clerk, lovelorn Sewell, who was turning her music for her.
"Yes, daughter."
Mr. Light's eyes flickered over Johnny.
"Quite the little gentleman from the waist up. Silver buttons, eh? Ruffled shirt."
His eyes slid over his little family party. He addressed them in so low a voice he seemed to ignore Johnny standing at the far upper end of the long room. He had been expecting some such apparition from the past ever since last August. In spite of family efforts to keep certain things dark, he had reason to believe certain things were well known, even among the, lower classes. Then he called to Johnny.
"Now, boy, you brought your cup?"
"It is here, in this bag."
"Very good. Will you and, all of you please step into the dining room?"
This took some time, for Aunt Best had to be pulled in front and pushed from behind before she was balanced on her two gold-headed canes. She scolded, muttered, and shook her whiskers at everyone, including her famous nephew. Only Lavinia, still at the spinet, and Cousin Sewell bending over her, did not go into the dining room. There on the sideboard were three standing cups. They were identical with Johnny's. Silently, he took his from its bag, set it with the other three, then stood back to look at the silken, bejeweled, perfumed folk crowding about him. Mr. Light took the cup, studied it, compared it with one of his own. Silently, he handed it to a plainly dressed, thick-set gentleman who thus far had said nothing.
"I think," said Mr. Light quietly, "all of you ladies and gentlemen will agree that this cup are, cousin, is it, has brought back tonight is one of this set?"
There was a murmur of assent. Johnny could hear the tiny tinkle, seemingly far away, of Miss Lavinia's spinet.
"It is perfectly obvious that this cup now stands where it belongs. The question is, how was it ever separated from its fellows?"
Johnny felt that everyone there except himself knew the answer to this question.
"In fact," the merchant's voice was smooth as oil, "I declare this to be the very cup which was stolen from me by thieves. They broke through yonder window on the 23rd of last August. Sheriff, I order you to arrest this boy for burglary."
The thick-set plain man whom Johnny had already noticed put a heavy hand on his shoulder. His formal words flowed over him.
"Johnny Tremaine, alias Jonathan Light Tremaine, apprentice to Ephraim Lapham, name of King and Bay Colony, standing cup, taken away the 23rd day, month, year of our Lord 1773.
"This is not true," Johnny said.
"You can explain that to the judge."
"Very well, I can and will." The full horror of the accusation for a boy might be hanged for stealing a silver cup, froze him into seeming nonchalance. This coolness made a bad impression. Aunt Best was poking at him with one of her canes. She hoped she'd live long enough to see him hanged. He was a perfect little viper, and he looked it. A florid woman was flapping a pink feather fan. She thought he had one of those falsely innocent little faces that are such an aid to evil boys. No, someone else was saying. He has a shifty eye. Aunt Best croaked. Look at those silver buttons on his coat. I'm sure he stole them. Mr. Light said, Boy, where did you get that coat? It was lent me. Lent you? By whom, pray? Apprentice boy? I don't know his last name. Down at the Observer office, he's called Rab. That coat is worth money. Do you think someone whose last name you admit you don't know would lend you a coat? It doesn't sound likely, but happens it's true. Sheriff, look into this. I certainly will, Mr. Light. I sent Sewell over to the Laphams, a very respectable, humble, pious, poor sort of folk. Mrs. Lapham swore this boy never owned a thing but the clothes he stood in. As for his name, she showed Sewell the papers of his indenture, signed by his dead mother. She put him down as Johnny Tremaine, no Jonathan Light about it. And Mrs. Lapham believed that lately he had taken to evil ways, stealing shoes and little things. She swore he never owned a cup. And Mr. Tweedy, a partner of Mr. Lapham, said the boy was a notorious liar and of most evil report. The sheriff was taking out his handcuffs, snapping them on Johnny's wrist and his own. "Soon's I get this scamp locked up, I'll be back for that bowl of punch you promised, Mr. Light," he called cheerfully as he left. The last sound Johnny heard was the fairy tinkle of the spinet. The chain clanked. The sheriff said nothing until he had reached the stone jail in Prison Lane. Then, as the jailer was writing down Johnny's name in his book, the sheriff said kindly, "Now, boy, you've got some rights. Who do you want notified? Got any canics at the lights, eh? How about old Mr. Lapham?" "He's my master no more. He dismissed me months ago." "Relatives, parents?" "I've nothing. But will you please tell that boy down at the Observer, he's a tall boy and dark. All I know is his name is Rab." "The one you stole the coat off, hey? I was going to look him up tonight." 4. Oddly enough, Johnny slept well in a straw pallet in the jail. The night before, lying and weeping among the graves of Copp's Hill, he had reached bottom. He could not go lower than that. No matter what happened, he could not help but now go up. He knew his honest childish squeals were nothing compared to the serious charge Mr. Light had brought against him, but the squeals had just about broken his heart. The accusation of burglary he could take. He felt tough enough and hard enough to take anything. But he could not help but think of the gallows just beyond the town gates, how they had loomed up at him through the dark of the night like a warning. Before he had finished his breakfast of corn gruel, Rab arrived. Johnny had known he would come. He brought blankets, books, food. Seemingly, by the nonchalance of his manner, nothing was more usual than to find one's friends in jail. About his muscular brown throat, Johnny could see a medal hung upon a string. On it was engraved a Tree of Liberty. So, Rab was one of the semi-secret famous Sons of Liberty, those carefully organized mobs who often took justice into their own hands. They frightened royal officers out of Boston, stopped British admirals from impressing Yankee seamen as they were impressed in England. They could at will paralyze trade, courts, government. Many a night Johnny had heard their whistles, conch shells, and cries of, "Town born, turn out!" The running of their feet. And the next day had seen the effigies they had hung, the Tory fences they had torn down or windows broken, and heard that Royal Commissioner so-and-so had been frightened out of Boston. Or such-and-such a merchant had wept when hailed before a Liberty Tree and sworn never to do trade with England until all grievances had been righted. The Laphams had hated such lawless seizure of government by the Sons of Liberty. Johnny had not thought much about it. Seeing the metal at Rab's throat made him think it might be fun to be out with them. The metal did its work, for both the turnkey and the jailer were also sons. Johnny was given a neat private room on the ground floor. Such rooms were usually reserved for gentlemen jailed for debt. Here he told Rab his entire story. Rab had already found out that the case would come up on the following Tuesday before Mr. Justice Dana. If Mr. Justice thought there was not sufficient evidence to hold him for a higher court and a jury trial, he would immediately release him. Then he asked if Johnny had shown his cup to any living soul sometime before August 23rd. Such a witness would prove that Johnny had owned a cup before Mr. Lights had been stolen. Why, of course! Scylla Lapham! That was July. Come to think, it was the very day Mr. Hancock ordered his sugar basin. It was the second day of July. That was a Tuesday. That's all you need. Mr. Light was a fool to bring so flimsy a charge against you. What do you suppose he meant when he said he had expected something like me turning up as soon as the cup was stolen? I don't know what goes on in that clever, bad head, but perhaps he thinks you're an imposter and stole the cup to first back up some claim of kinship. Of course, Scylla will come to court for you. She will, if her mother will let her. Would Mrs. Lapham give you a good character? No. She thinks these days I'm bad enough to steal a wig off a parson's head. Next day, Rab was back at the same time. He was a little perturbed. Mr. Light himself had been to the Laphams, in the ruby coach, and ordered a dozen silver spoons, a tea caddy, and, if all went well, would order a silver tankard a foot high. A bribe? Scylla says he paid in advance. Then it was Mrs. Lapham said she would not have her girl mixed up in such a disgraceful case. She promised Scylla would spend next Tuesday under lock and key. I could hang first. And she is determined to please that Mr. Tweedy, too. If he won't sign that contract and get right to work, she can't get Mr. Light's silver maid. Poor old Mr. Lapham won't do anything but read his Bible. Says he hasn't long to prepare to meet his maker. By the way, Mr. Tweedy just about hates you. Says you called him a squeak pig. He didn't like it. Of course I called him a squeak pig. Don't see why he cares. Well, you go around calling people squeak pigs and you've just about got to take it when they hit back. Not with their tongues, mostly they're not quick enough, but like this. Tweedy saw his chance to get back at you. He says if Mrs. Lapham lets Scylla testify for you, he'll take his ship back to Baltimore. Says he's sensitive and a great artist, and he can't be upset by thieves and brawlers. Well, never mind. But I don't see the point of going around and... Oh, forget those squeak pigs, for heaven's sake! Johnny was sulky. Now, for a lawyer. I've talked to Josiah Quincy. He often writes for The Observer. He says if you want him, he's ready. Josiah Quincy? But, Reb, you tell him not to... You don't want him? He's the best young lawyer in Boston. I could never pay him. You don't understand. He'll give you his time for nothing. He's coming to see you this afternoon. And I'm meeting Scylla sort of behind her mother's back to make plans. It all depends on Scylla, doesn't it? Well, pretty much. And Mrs. Lapham and the squeak, I mean Tweedy, say they'll lock her up. Lock her up so I can't get her out? Boy, I could get her out of this jail. Get her out of the Tower of London. And that girl would testify for you, even if it cost her her life. What's her real name? Priscilla? Well, may Priscilla be on my side if I'm ever accused of anything. What about the little girl? Is she really as bright as she looks? No, I don't think so. She's just sort of a parrot. She's always going around repeating what Scylla or anyone else says to her as if she had thought it up all herself. 5. Mr. Justice Dana was a stout and florid man, dressed in a black silk robe and a great woolly white wig. Johnny sat close to Mr. Quincy, watching the justice's nervous, taut hands, listening to his what-we-have-heres and quick questions to the men and women shoved up before him. Some people he dismissed, some he ordered fined, or whipped, or set in the stocks, or held for a higher court. Johnny knew when his own case would soon be called because he heard the justice tell a beadle to run down to the Long Wharf and tell Merchant Light to present himself in half an hour. Once again, Johnny squirmed about, studying every face in the courtroom. Rab and Scylla were not there, and he was frightened. Mr. Quincy whispered to him. Rab said he'd get here by 11. Rab's never slipped yet. Johnny liked his young lawyer, a frail man flushed with fever. His cough was prophetic of an early death. This was how Johnny's mother had died, burned up by fever, coughing herself to death. The man had a mobile, passionate face, handsome except for one wall eye. Mr. Light arrived, escorted by his poor relative and clerk, Sewell. He entered as though he owned the court, calling a cheery good morning to Mr. Justice, interrupting the mumbled explanation of a shabby bakeress accused of selling moldy bread. Next, there was a rattle of light gig wheels, a jingle of horse gear, and to the intense pleasure of everyone, Miss Lavinia Light entered, and as modestly as she was able, took a seat near the door. Even the justice straightened the bands at his throat. Sewell blushed. The bakeress forgot what she was saying as she turned to gape at the beautiful dark woman, darkly dressed. Restless, easily bored, Miss Light often did unexpected things. Jonathan Light versus Johnny Tremaine, alias Jonathan Light Tremaine. Mr. Quincy gave him a secret pat on the knee. Johnny knew he must now step forward, take his oath on the Bible to tell the truth, the whole truth, so help him God. He was frightened, for as he stepped forward he was conscious that these might be the first steps towards the gallows, waiting in the dark beyond the town gates. Next, Mr. Light was called and was taking the same oath. Mr. Quincy's one good eye caught Johnny's. He was forming words on his lips. The clock had indeed struck 11, and there, standing in the doorway, were Rab and Scylla. Rab, enigmatical, dark, capable, looked as always. Scylla had on a hood that half covered her face. Mr. Light was talking as informally as though he and Mr. Dana were alone together, sitting at a tavern, cracking walnuts, drinking Madeira. He told how his great-grandfather, Jonathan Light, mayor of Causeway, Kent, England, had had 6 identical cups made, one for each of his sons. 4 of these cups had come to this country, and these he himself had owned until last August. On the night of the 23rd, a thief or thieves had broken a pane out of his dining-room window. The space was too small to admit a grown man, so it was a half-grown boy who had slipped in and taken only one of the famous cups. Then he snapped his fingers at Sewell, who stepped forward and set 4 silver cups on the table before the justice. "This is the stolen cup," Mr. Light said confidently. "I've tied a red ribbon on it." Then he went on to tell, with considerable humor and a bright sparkle in his slippery black eyes, about Johnny's visit to his shop, his claims of kinship, and how he had lured him to his house with the stolen cup. The justice said, "Mr. Light, could it not be possible that this boy is related to you? Could his story be true?" "No, no, it was impossible. Would Mr. Justice Dana be so good as to glance at this indenture, which the boy's erstwhile master, Mr. Lapham, had been so kind as to lend him? The name was put down as Johnny Tremaine, nothing about Light. Undoubtedly older heads than this boy's had egged him on to this wretched scurvy trick, but Mr. Light had no wish to go into the matter beyond the recovery of his own property. He did not wish to suggest in any way that the Laphams had any part in the imposture. They were very humble, honest, pious folk. He believed that the cause of the theft, all that interested him at the moment, was dead open and shut against the boy. And might he ask for the death penalty? There was too much thieving going on in Boston. Poor apprentices were getting out of hand. The gallows had been too long empty. "That's for the court to say," said the justice sourly. He took snuff, and Mr. Light took snuff. They sneezed together. Mr. Quincy led Johnny on to tell his own story. The boy spoke confidently, now that Rab and Scylla were there. He had never had an audience before, and he felt the courtroom hanging on his words, believing him. He spoke better and better. He told how his mother had given him the cup, the little that she had told him. She had bidden him not to part with the cup, ever, nor ever to go to the lights unless he had come to the end of everything. Then he spoke simply and easily of his accident, his hunt for work, his despair, and arrest. There was a murmur almost of applause. "Johnny," said Mr. Quincy, "did you obey your mother? Never show your cup to anyone?" "Once I disobeyed. It was the second day of last July. I forgot, or didn't heed. I told my master's daughter, Priscilla Lapham, what my mother said was my true name and about the cup. She wanted to see it. It was just dawn. That is, the dawn of the 3rd of July. Tuesday it was. Scylla was called. Johnny had always thought her a shy girl, but she stood up straight before the judge, speaking in her clear, low voice. He was proud of her. And he had always thought her a skinny, plain girl. She looked at the moment just about beautiful to him. As she finished, there was a sensation in the courtroom that outweighed the arrival of Mr. Light and even his handsome daughter. Izana, her bright curls in wild array, flew into the courtroom seeming like a mouse to run without feet. She stopped for no oath, no formalities, but flung herself upon Mr. Justice Dana, telling over again Scylla's story. Johnny knew she had been sound asleep when he had told Scylla. She had even been in bed when he had actually shown the cup to her older sister. He was amazed at the vividness of her jumbled recital, and touched by the virtues she attributed to himself. Yet she was making it all up. In vain, Mr. Justice Dana's, "What have we here, and I cannot accept this as testimony," and Scylla's attempts to quiet her. She was so enchanting, so seemingly come from another world, she had her say.
"Bless me," said Mr. Justice, blowing his nose.
"And how old might you be?"
8, sir, going on for 9.
"There now, be a good girl. Here, you take this piece of licorice I have in my pocket and sit down quietly and eat it. There."
Almost immediately he dismissed the case. There was not the slightest evidence, the justice was saying, that the accused had stolen a cup, nor that the cup with the red ribbon, now illegally in the possession of Mr. Light, was the same one that was stolen from his house last August. Evidence was against that, for these young Lapham misses had proved to his satisfaction, and might he point out to Mr. Light his own testimony about the high character of honesty and piety the Laphams enjoyed, that, unlikely as it might seem, the apprentice had possession of a silver cup, undoubtedly one of the original 6 ordered by the mayor of Causeway, Kent. He bade Johnny Tremaine take the one with the red ribbon. It was his own. If he liked, he might even bring a suit against Mr. Light. Didn't recommend it. Mr. Light was too powerful. Johnny took the cup. In a moment, he and Mr. Quincy, Rab and Scylla, were standing in the sunshine of the street outside the courthouse. They were so happy they could only laugh. The lawyer said now they would all go together, as his guests, to a tavern to eat at their leisure and drink a health to Johnny from the cup. But where was Izana? She was standing with a tiny hand in one of Miss Light's gloved ones, gazing up at her in adoration. Scylla called her crossly. Miss Light stepped up into her high gig. It was a long step, but she was a lithe, long-legged woman.
"She said," panted Izana, "she had never seen anything like me, not even in some lane in London."
Drury Lane, said young Mr. Quincy dryly. I was thinking of that myself.
Rab, said the little girl, was I really all right?
Just about perfect. Only some of it you put in the first person, so it wasn't quite the truth, but you'll never starve. Then she tried to kiss Johnny, but he thought it beneath his dignity to be kissed on the street.
You're too mussed up with licorice, he said.
She bent and kissed his burned hand. He said nothing. He was suddenly afraid he might cry. Chapter 5. The Boston Observer. They went to the Afric Queen and ate in the dining room. This time no one asked to see the color of Mr. Quincy's money. The party even grew a little noisy. Izana, Johnny, and Mr. Quincy himself were the most hilarious. Many of the leading Whigs dined daily at the Queen, and one man after another stopped at their table to laugh over Merchant Light's public discomfiture that morning in court. Hadn't Quincy practically caught the old fox thieving a silver cup from an apprentice? Mr. Quincy, flushed and happy, agreed to all this, but more seriously he warned Johnny to watch out for himself. Mr. Light was very proud. That pride had been hurt. From now on, he was Johnny's enemy. But all enjoyed themselves, although Izana drank herself sick and silly on syllabubs. Johnny was disappointed when Rab told exactly how he had got Scylla to court that day. It was not half so exciting a story as Johnny had expected. Rab had simply shown Mrs. Lapham a letter signed by Governor Hutchison and stamped with the great seal of the colony. It had been sent to Mr. Lorne, commanding him and the other printers of Boston to quit their seditious, rebellious publications. Or else. Mrs. Lapham could not read. All Rab had done was to take Scylla by the arm, unfurl the letter at Mrs. Lapham, point to the seal and say, "Governor's orders." He had not given her time to call the well-educated Mr. Tweedy out of the shop. Rab and Scylla ran hell for leather to the courthouse. He had already schooled Izana and hidden her nearby in case he was unable to produce Scylla. Both girls, he thought, had done marvelously.
"That's what Miss Light said," the little girl agreed eagerly.
"At least she said I was wonderful, and..." "Oh, forget it," said Johnny rudely. "That Izana was just about getting above herself." During dinner it seemed to Rab that Johnny planned to go back to the Laphams to sleep, and to Scylla that he was moving in with Rab. But Johnny decided to sponge on neither. Not until he had a job, and something a lot better than delivering papers for Uncle Lorne. He had noticed the number of boys who came and went about the Queen's stable. The wind was howling up from the sea, beating the waves against the wharves. It was a fine fall, the days crisp and full of sparkle, but the nights, from now on, would be too cold in the open, although warm enough hidden away in a stable, with hay or a horse blanket to cover one and the warm animals giving off heat. He slept in the stable that night and on the next day did find a sea captain who would, in spite of the bad hand, take him on as a cabin boy. Johnny did not like the captain, the ship, nor the voyage. It was going to Halifax, and the cold turn the weather had taken and his insufficient clothing made him desire a trip to the tropic sugar isles above all else. But all seemed settled until the shipmaster casually told him he must furnish his own blankets, oilskins, sea boots, warm pea jacket. Johnny had no money to buy such things. Having no safe place now to leave his cup, he had tied the strings of the flannel bag to his belt. It struck him as he walked. The luckiest thing he had ever done was to disobey his mother and show this cup to Scylla last July. Now he would disobey her again and sell it. There were many silversmiths who would have bought it, but the cup was so old-fashioned he could not expect from them more than its value in old silver. However, Mr. Light, owning the matching cups, would pay a very good price. So, once more, he went to that merchant's counting-house on Long Wharf. It was the same as before, except Cousin Sewell was not there. The grasshoppery old clerks were bent over their ledgers. Neither moved as Johnny slipped quietly past them and entered the inner office.
Mr. Light looked up from his papers. There was a glimmer almost of hatred in the